Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, we have an action-packed show for you today. Of course, we're going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, you might be thinking to yourself, Jeff's voice sounds a little bit different today. And yes, it does, folks. I tested positive for COVID again, which, if my memory serves me correctly, is now the fourth time that I've gotten COVID. So bear with me on this, but as they say, the show must go on. Well, today we're going to catch you up on lots of motorsports, thermal with IndyCars, NASCAR, Miami, Martinsville, article about Tesla and what's happening with those cars. I've got a very good article about the tariffs and what is potentially going to happen as those go into effect next week. We'll also talk about a champion car, which is a car that was built by Studebakers. Of course, we'll talk about gas prices, and of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten your seatbelt nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Well, our first article today is from the pages of Arizona Family, and the headline reads, Trump's latest auto tariffs explained what car buyers should know about this year. And this is from the Associated Press, dated March 28th, from Detroit. President Donald Trump's 25% tax on imported cars, light trucks, and auto parts is likely to drive up prices at a time when many Americans are already struggling to afford a new set of wheels. The tariffs will also force car companies to rethink what cars they make and where they make them. Now, Trump has been itching to increase rates on foreign automobiles for years. In his first term, he also declared that auto parts that were a threat to national security, which gave him the authority to impose tariffs on them. On Wednesday, he went ahead and imposed those levies, and they take effect on midnight on April 3rd. The latest number of automotive industry maneuvers by Trump during his first weeks back in the White House, as auto companies are navigating the reversal of fuel economy standards, dialed down greenhouse gas emission standards, and a host of electric vehicle policy rollbacks. Here's some of the details about the auto tariffs that need to be worked out still. For example, it's unclear whether the new auto tariffs would stack up on top of the 25% import tax that's set to be levied next week on all goods from Canada and Mexico. That would mean that cars from Mexico and Canada could potentially face new tariffs of 50%. For now, the Trump administration is exempting from tariffs cars, light-duty trucks, and auto parts that would qualify for the duty-free treatment under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, a regional trade pact that the president negotiated 5 years ago. Trump intends to narrow the exemption to content made in the United States, not Canada or Mexico. This will require setting up a process to determine what qualifies as U.S.-made, something that could take weeks or even months. Now, the White House has also said the import tax would apply to key automotive parts, including engines, transmissions, powertrains, electrical components, that could expand the tariffs to other parts if necessary. Now, why are the tariffs so challenging to the automotive industry? Well, as automakers expanded globally, they created a complicated and efficient supply chain that spanned countries in North America. For instance, Mexico supplies low-wage labor and makes smaller, less expensive cars, while Canada and the United States provide more skilled labor and the technology know-how. Trump's tariffs are intended to bring back automotive manufacturing to the United States, but that won't be easy. Rerouting the sourcing of thousands of parts that are imported to the U.S. and uprooting assembly processes could take years. This adds uncertainty to facing the automakers as the industry supply chains is inherently global and has been optimized to move components across national borders where free trade agreements have existed in the past. Now, according to the Auto Forecast Solutions people, they note that European automakers of luxury vehicles and their buyers can afford the price adjustments. It's like companies like Toyota and Mazda and Subaru, who import large percentages of their fleets, will take a beating. Throwing tariffs on parts of vehicles built in Mexico and Canada that aren't sourced from the United States will hurt the profits of General Motors, Stellantis, and Ford over the next few quarters, costing them billions. Now, the Trump tariffs, he insists, are permanent, and they will force companies to make some hard choices. It's going to have the effect of forcing companies to increase their U.S. content if they want to dodge the import taxes. Now, even though Vanessa Miller, who is the chair of the automotive team, said that there are too many factories tied to Mexico elsewhere to make that move anytime soon, automakers will have to stop making vehicles because maybe they won't be profitable with tariffs in place. The tariffs will hit everyone in a manner that makes them rethink things. It's going to take 2 or 3 years before these changes can be permanent, so we're not looking at something that you can just ride out. Now, according to TD Economics estimates that the tariffs will raise the average price of cars and light trucks in the United States, which has totaled about $47,000 as of last month, upwards of $5,000 if the automakers pass along the entire cost to the consumers. And that price hike could go as high as maybe even $10,000 if the Trump administration applies the full tax to cars made in Mexico and Canada. Automakers and their suppliers are only now recovering from years of instability brought on by pandemic forces, production halts, and a sweeping semiconductor shortage, low inventory on lots. That meant prices were sky high and incentives were low and few deals were to be had during those days. Now, during the peaks of the pandemic, the consumers still bought cars at high volumes, but they were piling on tariffs could put new vehicles out of the reach of would-be buyers, especially those given the indications that a potentially broader inflation could be coming for the economy. Starting almost immediately, consumers will see already expensive new vehicles cost hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars to escalate even more when supply shortages are on key vehicles will start to dwindle. Imagine how prices rise during the semiconductor shortage, and now stretch that out across every manufacturer and every brand. The trickle-down effect will potentially put smaller suppliers out of business and send many workers into the unemployment line. Well, what about used cars? Well, by raising the prices of new cars, tariffs will likely send those buyers to the used car market. But with limited inventory, an influx of buyers could rock used car prices as well, and they're already averaging around $25,000. Lease penetration, or the number of lease transactions, which normally averages around 30% over the past 10 years, according to Edmunds data. But the industry saw lower rates of leasing, half to the norm, particularly between May 22 and January of 23. So fewer leased vehicles typically means less 2 or 3 year old vehicles being put on the used car market. Well, so there's likely to be a shortage of high quality used cars as many buyers will start looking for them. Now, according to the president of the American Automotive Council, which represents U.S. automakers, said that the manufacturers supported Trump's efforts to boost domestic automotive manufacturing, but he cautioned that it is critical that the tariffs be implemented in a way that avoids raising prices for the consumer and preserves the competitiveness of the integrated North American automotive market. The United Auto Workers Labor Union applauds the tariffs. Ending the race to the bottom in the automotive industry starts with fixing our broken trade deals, and the Trump administration has made history with today's actions, and that's according to the UAW President Sean Fain. These tariffs are a major step in the right direction for auto workers and blue-collar communities across the country. It's now the automakers from the Big Three to Volkswagen and beyond to bring back good jobs to the U.S. But according to the president and CEO of Auto Drives America, which represents international automotive manufacturers, denounces the tariffs, saying the tariffs imposed today will make it more expensive to produce and sell cars in the United States, ultimately leading to higher prices and fewer options for the U.S. consumer. Well, it's very interesting. I had some work done on my Chevrolet Corvette last week. And I looked at the box that the parts came in, and these were not major parts. One was called a belt tensioner, which helps keep the tension on the main drive fan belt. That was made in Canada, but was assembled over in Europe. And also the belt was made in Thailand. So these are parts that are boxed as Delco parts, but were manufactured in foreign countries. And these parts, even though they're American parts for American cars, would be affected by this new tariff. Well, from the pages of Hemmings magazine, the headline reads, "The champion was a knockout." Well, hello, fellow Hemmings fans. I imagine a few of you are familiar with my name, and his name is Pat Foster. and why they gave me a whole page in this magazine. I've been writing as a freelancer for Hemming since 1990 and had a column in Hemming's classic Cars right from issue number one. Well, recently the editor of Hemming's Motor News asked me if I'd be interested in transferring my column to the flagship magazine. So here I am, first day on the job. Now, I've always written about American independent brands, and I will continue to do so until Mike tells me to stop and do something else. I welcome feedback from the readers. Also, feel free to comment. So here we go. I think the most Hemming's readers know how badly the Great Depression decimated the ranks of the American independent automotive companies, killing off such great brands as Cord, Pierce Arrow, Peerless, and many more. Thankfully, a few independents managed to survive the Great Depression. One of those was Studebaker. The company was in receivership for a while. Emerging from that receivership took a little bit of time to get into growth mode. And one of the important lessons of the Great Depression was that only the biggest companies survive. The big three survived because of their vast financial resources. Dealership networks enabled them to endure America's worst economy downturn ever. Now, the Studebaker management realized they needed to increase sales volume. It was only a matter of time before they were overwhelmed by the competition. They resolved to develop a volume-selling car. Now, one thing is, volume-selling cars get the way they are by being a lower price than other cars. The upper and mid-lower range price cars were Studebaker's traditional market. Now, to compete with Chevy, Ford, and the Plymouth market, Studebaker needed a car that's priced like them. It's like the chicken and the egg. Build a high volume car, you need to have a low price. To get a low price, you need to build a high volume car. So which comes first? Now, Studebaker's first low price cars, the 1910 Flanders, the 1927 Erskine, and the 1932 Rockne, all failed. The engineers would design from the ground up and focus on weight reduction to achieve costs. It wouldn't be a small car, this new vehicle they're building wouldn't be a small car because Americans were conditioned to standard size vehicles, period. But it was risky. The company was walking a tightrope, earning only $2 million in 1936. However, only $812,000 in 1937, losing $1.7 million in 38. And however, with a mere 1.4% of the market, Studebaker had to take a chance and do something differently. Then the engineers began by designing a new six-cylinder engine, which weighed 455 pounds, 155 to 278 pounds lighter than the competitors' engines, yet built for durability with large main bearings, full pressure lubrication, and a sealed water pump. A lower weight engine, a lot of engineers paired off excessive driveline components. The frame and elsewhere, they dismantled four American and four European low-priced cars, weighing each one of these to set the goals for their weights. They kept the body weight within the pounds of the contemporaries to ensure that the car wouldn't sound tinny. The project costs for this were $4.5 million. Big for that time, but it resulted in a sensational car. Dubbed the Champion, the new car weighed just 2,389 pounds, not much more than what a Vega or a Pinto weighed, enabling good fuel economy with just 78 horsepower with a flathead engine, plus outstanding fuel economy. Priced at just $660 for the basic coupe, $700 for the club coupe, and $740 for the four-door sedan. The Champ was competitive with the low price three and $200 less than the Studebaker Commander. Now, the Champion offered a lot for the money. Independent front suspension, variable ratio steering, vented windows, a column shifter for three-speed transmission. The Studebaker acclaimed Hill Holder was an option along with overdrive and a climatized ventilation system. Body styling was overseen by Claire Hodgman. The Champion's appearance was quite handsome, and they inspired the designers by placing large posters around the design studio declaring, "Wait is the enemy." Superb engineering and rigorous quality testing were obvious to the road testers who praised the Champion's ride, handling, and value for the money. Since Studebaker was known as producing quality cars, the Champion has had an added cachet. The Champ was a hit. Studebaker's total passenger car sales were just 41,500 in 1938, soared to 84,660 in 1939, and in 1940, 102,281. And it wasn't just the Champion model. Increased showroom traffic helped boost sales of Studebaker Commanders and Presidents as well. And Studebaker's low-selling pickup trucks even saw an increase in sales. With Champion, the Studebaker was firmly in the low-price field, and it would grow mightily in the post-war era. Unfortunately, the product decisions would send it on a path of extinction. For some motorsports, last weekend, the Chinese Grand Prix had Oscar Piastri winning the race, driving for McLaren. Lando Norris finished in second, driving for McLaren, and George Russell finished in third, driving for Mercedes-Benz. Well, besides the 1-2 finish for McLaren, the big story in Formula One this week was Red Bull confirms Tsunoda promotion to Red Bull and Lawson returns to Racing Bulls. Well, Red Bull has confirmed a driver swap with Yuki Tsunoda and Liam Lawson, which will put Tsunoda alongside Max Verstappen at Red Bull Racing's team for the Japanese Grand Prix. And moving forward, Lawson was only selected to replace Sergio Perez ahead of Tsunoda in December, and just two races with Red Bull prior to that change being made. The New Zealander was unable to escape first qualifying sessions and qualified last in China. Despite his poor start, Red Bull cited Lawson's mental strength and great potential as two key reasons he was given the drive at, with just 11 Grand Prix starts in the prior two seasons. So it was a shock to see this U-turn so early. The call to make this change was reached with involvement of the key principals of the Red Bull stakeholders following the Chinese Grand Prix, and said that the Tsunoda's experience is now being deemed more valuable against the backdrop of Max Verstappen's own difficulty in getting consistent pace out of the new car. It was difficult to see Liam struggle in the RB21, which is the new car, with just two races. We came into the 25 championship season with two ambitions, regaining the World Constructors Championship and retaining the World Driving Championship. We realize there's a lot to be done on the RB21, and we're hopeful that Yuki's experience will be beneficial in helping the new car get back up to pace. So Yuki Tsunoda is switching places with Liam Neeson. Liam Lawson is going to go back to the junior team, which is called he's going to Red Bull Racing, which is the primary team, and Racing Bulls is the junior team, and he is now going to go back. So a driver swap at Red Bull, we'll see if it works. Well, last weekend, the IndyCars were over in Thermal, California, and as you know, it was warm here and it was hot in Thermal. Well, Alex Palou went on to win the race. He won the race last year. It was just a it wasn't a points race last year. It was an exhibition. But Pato O'Ward and Christian Lundgaard, driving for McLaren, finished second and third. So that means in the Formula One series, McLaren won that race. They finished first and second. And in IndyCar, they finished second and third. So it was a big, big day for McLaren in IndyCar and Formula One. So with the IndyCar season, Fox is the new broadcasting partner, and right during the middle of the race, they lost their feed. And what happened was is that there was some issues with the heat in California, and they lost a circuit breaker, which put 15 minutes of the race was not able to be viewed, and they went to the NASCAR race, which was live on Fox Sports 1 at the same time. So if you tuned into the IndyCar race in the middle and you're wondering, why am I seeing a NASCAR race? That was the reason why. There was a circuit breaker that had a 15-minute hole in the coverage of the IndyCar race, which they filled with NASCAR. Well, last weekend, NASCAR was down in Florida, and the headline reads, Larson pounces on Bowman Error to win another at Homestead. Well, Kyle Larson took advantage of Hendricks Motorsports teammate Alec Bowman scrubbing the wall late in Sunday's race at Homestead Speedway to grab his first win of the season. Bowman led with seven laps to go when his Chevrolet got too close to the wall in turn four, and by the time Bowman could pull it off the wall, Larson was driving by on the inside and went on to win by 1.2 seconds. So we have a 1-2 finish for Hendricks Company's Chevrolets. Kyle Larson wins. Alex Bowman from Tucson, Arizona, finishes in second. Bubba Wallace, driving for Michael Jordan's team, finishes in third. Chase Briscoe in fourth. And rounding out the top five was Denny Hamlin. On their short track binge right now, and they're going to be in Martinsville today. And well, Christopher Bell wins the pole. Chase Elliott's going to start in second. Alex Bowman from Tucson, Arizona, as I said, will start in third. And Kyle Larson, who won the race last weekend, will start in fourth position. And that race will be at 12 noon today, and that will be on Fox Sports 1. Well, some weird and unusual automotive news from the pages of AZ Family. Flagstaff women say they were targeted and assaulted for driving a Tesla car. Well, violence against Tesla is building in cities across the country. Vehicles set on fire in Las Vegas, graffiti on cars in Colorado, and a man caught keying a Tesla on camera in Dallas. Now Tesla owners are under attack in Arizona. Recently, a woman who wants to remain anonymous under the alias Susan told the Arizona Family that she was driving along Route 66 in Flagstaff when another vehicle started chasing her. "I'm just appalled," Susan said. "I didn't buy a car for a political statement. I bought it because it's really fun to drive. My politics have nothing to do with that, and I'm ashamed of our society and what they're doing." Well, Susan has a video of the Tesla attack in Flagstaff that last week, and it shows a green car pulling up next to her Tesla and then swerving in front to box it in. The driver then walks over to the 61-year-old woman in the Tesla and reportedly started hitting her while she was behind the wheel. "I started to say, 'You cut me off. What's your problem?' But I don't know how much of that he heard. He got out and just started punching me with a closed fist. At one point, the victim said that she bit the man's hand. A moment later, the passenger of the green car appears to walk over and pull the attacker away, finally getting back in their car and driving off. The police later cited the suspect, who is now due in court on Monday. The incident is the latest attack or threat against Tesla drivers in Arizona, seemingly targeting them for the vehicles they drive. Arizona Family spoke to another person who said she left a grocery store recently in Flagstaff and found a note on her car that said she's a Nazi and a loser. A few weeks later, she received a threatening call calling her a racist pig. Now, both Tesla owners are targeted to have recently signed up for gun safety because they feel that their life is in danger. The Takedown Tesla, which is a scheduled more than 200 peaceful protests at Tesla dealerships around this weekend. Several of those protests will take place in Metro Phoenix this weekend. Well, let's talk some gas prices with our friends at AAA. Right now, the average gas price in the United States is $3.15 per gallon. Here in Arizona, $3.33 is average for statewide. Over in New Mexico, $2.91. Colorado, $3.05. Utah, $3.16. Nevada, $3.86. In California, $4.79. That cheap gas in the general vicinity, Texas at $2.74, Oklahoma $2.71, Mississippi at $2.68. All right, let's see what's going on with our gas prices here in Arizona and Metro Phoenix. The least expensive gas in the state is down in Casa Grande. You can get $2.59 a gallon at the 76 station, as well as the Circle K. The Fast Trip is at $2.65, and these are all in Casa Grande. Eloy, the Fuel Express, is at $2.69. So, yeah, right now the least expensive gas is south of the metro in Casa Grande and Eloy. Let's see what's going on with our prices here in Metro Phoenix. Expensive gas in the metro, you're going to still be south down in Maricopa. Now, Circle K in Maricopa, the Fries, the Quick Trip are all at $2.99 a gallon. No gas in the general metro area besides that is under $3 a gallon. Costco and 79th Avenue in Glendale is at $3.04. The Sam's Club on 83rd Avenue in Glendale is at $3.04 as well. The Arco station on 43rd Avenue is at $3.05. That is a cash price. And the Arco station on Northern Avenue, that 2740 West Northern Avenue, is at $3.05 as well. Always like to take a look at the world gas prices right now, and this is U.S. dollar and U.S. gallon is the size. Iran, you can get a gallon of gas for 10 cents. Libya, it's 12 cents. Venezuela, it's 13 cents. Definitely places I don't know that I would want to live, even though the gas prices are cheap. Kuwait, $1.29. Qatar, $2.81. Saudi Arabia, $2.35 a gallon. Russia, the average gas price is $2.71. Indonesia, $3.14. Colombia, $3.83. China, $4.09. Japan, $4.69. Ukraine, $5.20. Let's cruise on down here. And then we get to the most expensive gas. Israel, $7.71. And rounding out the most expensive gas in the world, $12.97 a gallon in Hong Kong. Show, it's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I drive a 2018 Ford Edge, and it's been great. This past summer, on a 95-degree day when I live in southwest Arkansas, my heater started blasting out very hot air. At the same time, the temperature on the car screen said it was minus 40 degrees outside. I assume you know that that wasn't true. So I couldn't get it to reset and start to run the AC again, despite several attempts that day. The next morning, after doing nothing more to fix it, the AC works fine. The next day I was at the dealership and they asked them what their explanation was, and they didn't have any good idea what happened. So thank you for your entertaining column, and let me know what your thoughts are. And that's from Carolyn. Informative column. Well, we'll see about that. My guess is your ambient air temperature sensor went, using the technical term, went kerflooey. You have an automatic climate control system. Now, when it's on, and it's almost always on, whether you're heating or air conditioning the cabin, you simply set your desired temperature, and then the climate control system does the rest. To do that, it measures the temperature inside the cabin and outside the cabin. If the temperature outside the cabin is 95, and you want the temperature inside to be 72, It knows it needs to run the air conditioning on high. And then vice versa. When the temperature outside is 45 and you want it to be 72, well, it has to blast the heat for a while. It sounds like me that your outside temperature sensor went rogue. And it was telling you that it was minus 40 outside. So it was telling your climate control system that, not surprisingly, it started blasting the heat. And why did this happen? Well, it could be a one-time fluke. Maybe it'll never happen again. But like other modern components and electronics, things printed with circuit boards, sometimes they just fail and need to be replaced. Once the ambient air temperature sensor went back to normal overnight, everything seemed to be functioning fine. And it may continue. But if it happens again, I'd have the shop replace the sensor. It'll probably cost you around $100, including labor. That certainly is a lot less than the constant hair care required when it's 95 degrees outside and the heat is blasting inside. Yeah, I think that's going to be a pretty simple fix. It's a pretty normal problem to have, and especially here in Arizona when we have such massive heat temperatures outside and we need it to be nice and cool, comfortable inside. Those sensors definitely need to be operating at their peak condition. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name is Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.